This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Last week, the families of troops who went missing during the Korean War gathered in Washington, D.C. They heard the latest from government officials about efforts to return their loved ones' remains. That briefing happens every year, but this year brought large crowds with a palpable sense of hope. In June, Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reached an agreement that led to the transfer of 55 boxes that may contain the remains of service members. And with recent scientific advances, there is a higher chance than ever before of finding out who those service members are. WUNC military reporter Jay Price was at the meeting in Washington and joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Jay.
Oh, thanks for having me, Frank.
So we've been hearing reports about these remains, 55 boxes of possible remains. I mean, tell us what we know about what we have, what was returned.
Well, and you know, the backdrop for this is there are almost 8,000 missing still from that war. That's a lot, and most of them in the North. And I talked to the two top scientists at the lab responsible for making identifications of missing troops for the United States. Both have a lot of experience with remains from North Korea, especially with 208 boxes that the North Koreans returned in the 1990s, which turned out to have the remains of an estimated 400 U.S. service members mixed up kind of willy-nilly, not one to a box, but sometimes parts of six or seven to a box. They look carefully through all of these 55 boxes, and they say the contents is really similar to those earlier ones, meaning mainly bone fragments and kind of poor to middling condition, some teeth, a few artifacts like boots and belt buckles that can't really be tied to anyone, but very few whole bones.
Tell us more about this meeting, because it happens every year. Who attends this meeting? What's the purpose of it? And then tell us more about this year's meeting.
Well, the federal government puts this on to keep the families of the missing up to date on everything from diplomatic efforts with this particular country. You know, it has these meetings around the country, and most of them are more generic. They're for the families of missing of all the wars who want to show up and see what's going on, what the latest is. But this one is specifically for the families of folks who went missing in the Korean and Cold Wars. The Cold War numbers very, very small. So in effect, most of the family members who show up for this are Korean War families. About 800 of these family members showed up. I mean, this is a pretty huge meeting. And they give them everything from information on plans to disinter unknown troops buried on U.S. soil. There's a new plan for that. To advances in science. And every year, you know, there's a new one for this, you know. Technically, you know, this is, again, for the Korean War families, but there were some Cold War folks there.
And you have to ask, or I have to ask, where is the there may be the techniques to determine the DNA of the fragments and the remains that are in these boxes, but then you have to have the DNA from individuals to match it with. How do they get that?
Yeah, they've had a really successful effort over the years with Korean War families in particular. They've got DNA samples from 92% of these families. And, you know, some is one kind of DNA versus another. But the sample is very, very easy to do. In fact, they had a table set up at the meeting for anyone who hadn't had it done before. And so they've got this kind of library, this index they can measure against to more quickly make an identification once they get DNA from some of the bones involved. They also have, from the National Archives, unearthed a bunch of chest x-rays. All the soldiers, troops from the Korean War era had chest x-rays, and they've got those for about 72% of the soldiers. And those are almost like, you know, some of the bone shapes in the upper body are almost like a thumbprint for identification purposes.
Now, obviously, the last shot in the Korean War was fired more than 60 years ago. But as you suggest, and as the numbers suggest at that meeting in D.C., this is still important to a lot of people. You spoke with Richard Downs, who is the son of Air Force Lieutenant Hal Downs, whose bomber went down in 1952. Richard is president of the Coalition of Families of Korean and Cold War POW/MIAs. You had a conversation with him. Let's hear how that went.
That's the key right now, is how do we keep this going rather than let it just be another time we look back on and say, oh yeah, remember when that happened and nothing followed. We want to be able to look back on this and say, remember when that happened? That's when it began. And then we still don't know what that end would be.
If you fall backward one more time, most of the people who knew these men are going to be dead.
Well, yeah. Most of them are already dead.
Yeah. Anyway.
But they're still the people that have a wound that can be healed from this. And so that's what we're hoping to do.
It was WUNC military reporter Jay Price speaking with Richard Downs, who is the president of the Coalition of Families of Korean and Cold War POW and MIAs. How have people maintained hope in this whole period?
Well, in part by coming to these meetings. You know, the people who come, they've created essentially an extended family among themselves, kind of a giant support group. You know, they show up year after year after year. This is a stable population of missing people, right? It's the same. So it's the same families in many cases, only more and more of them, it seems like. But, you know, this is one of the things I broached with Mr. Downs. And, you know, he said, yes, you know, we've all come to know each other, you know, and even when I just meet someone, it's like we have common issues, and it's almost like we're already friends. But one of the other things I was trying to get at with him there was this kind of palpable sense of hopefulness. And it wasn't just about the 55 boxes. He's been coming to these things for more than a decade. And he said this was, you know, the most positive and upbeat one he's been to in a while. Part of it was that the families are now being treated as partners, he said, by the U.S. government. They're, you know, in some cases, these pretty high officials would call out from the stage, you know, some family member's name and say, oh, yeah, he asked about this the other week, and I was able to tell him that, you know, responding to someone else's question. The officials and the families all know each other by name at this point in some cases. But earlier, there had been all kinds of problems with the agency that is tasked with recovering and identifying these remains. It was basically kind of stitched together. You have to understand this effort is essentially unique for the United States. No other nation cares about this in the same way that America cares about this. And so this whole effort to recover and identify was something they had to invent from scratch. And it was organized poorly. I think everyone agrees it was organized poorly to begin with. It was just stitched together in a way that wasn't functioning well. He says it's functioning really well now. And instead of shoving the families away, keeping them at arm's length and essentially treating them as if they were nuisances, they're partnering with them, trying to make the identifications happen more quickly and more smoothly, and giving them information so that they're not frustrated all the time, and so they can understand some of the bureaucracy here and some of the, you know, in this case, there are these terrible diplomatic issues right. with North Korea to help them kind of understand what's going on behind the scenes and what it all means for them.
Well, and you've been following the story of a North Carolina woman whose uncle went missing during the war in the Chosen Reservoir in that area in North Korea in 1950. Tell us more about her.
Well, Jennifer Castaldi brought her daughter, Jessica Dillon, and a close friend with her. PFC Marshal Lindley Bush, who went by the name Lynn, was her uncle. She tries to come to the meeting every year. She feels like she needs to do this for her mother, who's ill and can't attend, and is the last of Lynn's three siblings. He had a twin brother, identical twin, who died just last year. So in a strange kind of ghostly way, she feels like she knew him, even though she never met him. And, you know, as the relatives who actually knew the missing men die off, you know, I wanted to talk to her about how a tragedy like this ripples down through a family for generations, affecting relatives who didn't know them, nieces and nephews.
Yeah, and you talked with her. This is Jennifer Castaldi of Winston-Salem about her uncle's disappearance in Korea and the effect on her grandmother.
I know for a fact that my grandmother shut down a lot about life after she lost her son. I would often just find her sitting in the corner crying. She existed. She just existed after that.
Jennifer Castaldi of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, talking about how her uncle's disappearance in the Korean War affected her grandmother. And she had that conversation with WUNC military reporter Jay Price, who's with me now. You talked about efforts also in the United States and developments in DNA science that are actually advancing things, and a volcanic crater in Hawaii that holds a National Memorial Cemetery in the Pacific.
Yeah, DNA strands start to break down fairly quickly. So, you know, these are in much worse shape than crime investigations, for example, usually deal with. And no other nation goes to anything like the lengths that we do to recover and identify them. So this kind of work is really a work in progress, the how part, how we find the remains, how we test the DNA, how the anthropologists use teeth and the shapes of what are mainly bone fragments. The science of all this is advanced constantly by the very labs doing it, including these really advanced DNA techniques. There's a volcanic crater in Hawaii that, you know, has this cemetery, and it has about 800 remains from the Korean War that are much like the ones that we want to recover from North Korea but can't get to currently because of the diplomatic issues. But we have these, and in theory, we can identify these remains, but they were treated with formaldehyde, unlike the ones in the field. And for a long time, they thought that that was going to prevent any sort of identification from DNA, that it had essentially destroyed the DNA. But 2 years ago, they made an advance that's going to allow them to have really high success rates with these remains. So they're now planning to dig these up in phases.
And that'll help with the correlation for the other remains that come over that we think may not have been treated by formaldehyde, but could be very helpful in the identification process.
Yep.
Good stuff. Jay Price, WUNC Military Reporter. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks again.
Just ahead, we're going to hear stories from WUNC's Youth Reporting Institute. You'll hear that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.